Hey guys, real quick before we get started, we are doing a free giveaway for listeners between now and May 31st. Cash prizes, free swag, yacht meetup tickets, San Diego Padre tickets, and more. All you got to do to qualify is go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and drop a 5-star review. Send a screenshot to giveaway@summerscapital.com and we'll be selecting lucky winners May 31st. As always, I appreciate the support. Now let's jump into the show.
You got to be able to deal with a high level of uncertainty. And that's why most entrepreneurs, I talk about in my book, can deal with chaos, because most grew up in chaos to a certain degree, right? They went through some challenges, and in those challenges, they learned to deal with uncertainty. And it turns out in business, that ability is what's rewarded. Think about it, man. In the eye of the storm, everybody else would be freaking out, crying, having anxiety, depression. Like, they would just be like, you're just like, bring it.
Yeah.
Let's make a list. Let's attack it. No problem.
Welcome to the Rich Summers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show.
All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the Report. Today, we are back in the studio here in downtown San Diego, and I got a special guest who just flew in from Canada. He invests in private equity. He is a best-selling author, and he helps entrepreneurs build and scale their businesses. I got Dan Martell. Dan, welcome to the show.
Rich, it's an honor, man. I love the setup you got here. Obviously, I'm a fan of your work, and it's a real honor to be here.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you coming down. I know we first connected on Instagram maybe like 6 months ago. It's good to meet in person finally. Where in Canada do you live?
Kelowna, BC. Inland from Vancouver. In the mountains. It's kind of like if Tahoe had like a real city. So we have about 300,000 people there.
Okay.
But it's very much a mountain lake town.
Nice. And so you flew down this morning in your plane, and you landed in Boise for customs, or did you do that in San Diego?
Yeah. No, I did it in Boise. I talked to my pilot this morning because I feel like we do this all the time. Yeah. And I don't understand, like, I'm coming to San Diego. Why can't we clear customs here? Mm-hmm. Now, it's a long jaunt. I think it was like 4.5-hour flight, so we have to refuel anyway. So, and the Boise, the woman there, Rachel, is so nice, like the customs person. It's actually it's a nice experience.
Okay. And you have a citation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
Grant Cardone used to have a citation 560, I want to say. Now he's got a Gulfstream. Citation do you have?
CJ2.
CJ2. Okay. Yeah. And one pilot or two pilots?
One. That's why I like
solo.
It. Yeah.
What is it like hiring a pilot? I'm just curious.
So it's fun. So we have a dedicated pilot, but when he's not available, we have Ben, Ben, our pilot. So we fly him around though. So like if we go, like a few weeks ago, we were in Colorado for a few days. He like flew us down, then flew home, then flew back. So yeah. So there's actually a whole network of pilots if you need them.
Gotcha. So he'll leave the plane here. He'll fly commercial
home.
He'll
fly home.
And then come back and grab you in a few
days. Yeah, sometimes he'll take an Uber. One time he took like a 2-hour Uber because that was more efficient than getting on a flight.
Do you ever just put him up in a hotel wherever you are for a few days?
He's got a family.
Gotcha.
Yeah, Ben's a stud. So again, we have essentially two pilots, one dedicated and then Ben, and it's just easier to figure it out. But the cool part is my assistant deals with it all. So we just give the travel itinerary, and I don't even know what airport I landed in. You know, somebody was asking me earlier, they're like, what airport are you at? I'm like, I do not know.
Did you come into San Diego Airport, or did you go to one of the satellite ones?
Same answer. I literally don't even know. It's not, I'm pretty sure.
It's one of the smaller ones?
Montgomery.
Okay.
Yeah, Montgomery.
Yeah, that one's not too far up. Chris Krohn was on the podcast about a month ago, and he was telling me he's got two smaller jets, and he charters them out when he's not using them. Do you charter yours out?
No.
You don't?
No, I'm jealous of the people. So in Canada, we don't have the same tax write-off as you guys. And we don't have a charter network the way the US does. What I do love about Chris says, he calls it Jesus and Jets. And I just kind of love that. I love that philosophy.
Do you guys get any tax benefits in Canada for owning a jet?
No, not like
nothing.
Really? Nope.
What about real estate investing? Do you guys get a lot of tax advantages?
What do you guys got? The 1031? No.
None of that.
Dude, don't even start.
We got to get Canada
on board.
It's
a lot of work. So a lot of my stuff is in the US because of that. But there's still like, there's a whole lot of infrastructure I have to put in place to be able to take advantage of the tax opportunities.
Gotcha. And so you got a productive day. You're going to go see Kent later.
Yeah.
How do you know Kent?
I met Kent at an event. We were both speaking, but again, Instagram, like it was so fun, like following your stuff and like just, you know, liking and messaging you. And then Kent, same thing. It's like, I came across this stuff and I can just tell listening to somebody if they actually know what they're doing. Mm. You know, there's like a bunch of internet gurus out there that are actually like full of crap. And I've just been building companies for 25 years. So I can, when Kent spoke, I was like, oh, this is an operator. This is a person that actually knows how to build and scale companies. So we became fans of each other's. And when I told him I was coming to San Diego, he's like, well, stop by the house. Let's do the podcast. So
I love that, man. Yeah. He was sitting right here in that chair, I want to say a week and a half ago. But that was a good conversation and good dude. It's cool to interview someone that lives in La Jolla, man, literally like 10 minutes away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, man, so tell us a little bit about what you're doing today. Just kind of big picture what you do.
Yeah. I mean, I have like three big parts of my life. I've got the SaaS Academy side. So I run the largest CEO coaching organization for software CEOs. So we have over 1,000 active clients. We coached everybody from ClickFunnels, Hyros, Alex Becker. I mean, you name it, Garrett J. White, Ryan Dice, Ryan Levesque, anybody in the internet online space that have a software product, I've probably coached them over the years. So that's like one part of my life. And then the other one is I have a $100 million kind of, it's not a private equity fund because it's our own capital, but essentially it's a holding company. Mm-hmm. So we've set it up so that we can buy profitable SaaS companies. So software as a service is kind of what I do.
Okay.
So I spend a lot of my time with my business partner, Kevin, looking at deals, and we've already bought two this year. We'll probably get another two done before the end of the year.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll probably buy about 12 companies over the next 3 years.
Yeah, you mentioned there's a lot of people putting out content right now, and you can kind of see through the ones that are, you know, are not speaking from a place of experience. But I think one thing, you know, that you're doing, which I love, is you have a fund and you're actively buying business.
No, it's not even
right?
a fund. It's not even a fund. It's what my own capital.
It's your own capital.
Yeah.
Which is even more impressive.
Yeah, that's what everybody says is like, oh, do you have a fund? I'm like, nope. I've done almost 100 angel investments with my own capital, first money in, seed stage. I've done like Udemy, Hootsuite, Unbounce, Intercom. I mean, I've been in angel investing for almost 15 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
But I just started producing content like 7 years ago. I was telling you when we came to Mission Beach, I was in the city and my buddy Travis, do you know Travis Houston?
I did not.
Okay. He's local. He's cool dude. He's like the marketing automation guy behind a lot of the top folks around here. He's the one that got me on YouTube. So he's the one, like he said, after I did my company Clarity and we exited, he goes, you should do a YouTube channel. And I said, I'm an adult. I'm not doing that. And he's like, no, you should consider doing it. So like the first videos I ever shot was downtown San Diego.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love that, man. And you and your family come down on vacation here now?
We used to come every summer or every winter up until COVID happened. And now we're doing more like new countries. So we do two new countries a year. Mm-hmm. But Encinitas is kind of our happy place.
Yeah. So, you know, we got a lot going on right now with, you know, the economy. The Fed has all the control right now with the interest rates. But we're in a period where we're going to see the greatest transfer of wealth in American history go down over the next 7 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard different numbers, but you know, around 40 million baby boomers are going to be retiring over the next 7 years. And they hold a lot of these businesses in America. So, with this opportunity, that we're going to be seeing over the next 7 years, where do you specifically see the most opportunity for the everyday person?
Everyday person. I mean, I spend most of my time in high tech. So I just literally signed paperwork on a AI company that I'm involved in today. So like in San Diego.
Congrats, by the way.
Thank you. I mean, the everyday person, I mean, I hope it doesn't sound so simplistic, but like, I just believe that any person that wants to make themselves more valuable by investing in their skills is like the best place. And here's why, Rich, because like I get entrepreneurs messaging, you know, like we get hundreds of these people every day message, like, how do I start? Where do I go from here? I just tell them to like figure out what can you learn to become more valuable, right? And sales is probably the best place to start because learning how to communicate, persuade, have somebody else get excited about your opportunity, get them involved. I mean, that works for recruiting, that works for raising capital, that works for getting customers. That's usually a really great place to start. And then I usually tell them to do the research, figure out where the trends are going. You know, I had a mentor of mine a long time ago when I moved to San Francisco from Canada. He goes, all you got to do is find out what the trends are, because he goes, high tides rise all boats. Mm. So this is 2008. I moved to San Francisco. I built and sold a company before that. Essentially, that was when social media took off, right? Web 2.0, 2009. So that was literally the next company I built. And then after that, I did a marketplace company. And in my industry, I look at the research reports. And I don't think people do this, but you know this because there's like real estate research reports, like mm-hmm. find the trends of what's the next, you know, 5 to 8 years, what's going to be, you know, productive in the market and then get involved in that. So again, in tech, if people are like, hey, what should I get involved in AI. Like if you just did consulting in AI right now and you started getting really good at building GPTs and understanding the different AI technology, in 5 years, you're going to be valuable to the market. If you're in real estate, you know that space better than I would just figure out what's the equivalent in that and then build the skills, but be in that industry so that you can ride the wave. Because again, high tides rides all boats.
Yeah, I agree with you. Sales is like the number one skill you can learn. If you can sell... you always have opportunity, whether it's raising capital,
always
starting a business, just driving traffic, closing deals. You will always have opportunity, even if you have nothing.
And you're on the streets,
you can go, someone will come hire you and pay you to come sell their product.
And this is what I tell people, Rich, because like I wrote this book called Buy Back Your Time. And people always, because in the book, I talk about this sequence called the replacement ladder. Chapter 5 is about like, if you were to start from zero, what sequence of hiring would you do in what order? And I told people like, this is the sequence. Like if I lost it all tomorrow, the first hire is an administrative assistant, because all I'm going to be doing all day long is dialing for dollars, selling the thing that I can do for people, delivering on that. And while I'm going and I'm creating all this opportunity, I'm giving all the administrative stuff to somebody else, so that I only spend my time enrolling people into my service and then delivering on that service. And I mean, that's the biggest opportunity. People, I think sometimes these young people think that like, I got to do something cool, or if it's not big enough, then it's not interesting enough. You just got to get in the game. Just get in it. Just learn the skills, like be in business.
What are your thoughts on the feedback loop? Because, you know, certain businesses have a longer barrier to entry. Maybe not necessarily the most expensive barrier to entry, but it could be a long time horizon to where you actually get some sort of feedback versus something to where you go into and you can start selling a product the next week. For someone new starting a business, do you recommend they go into something with a shorter time horizon?
It's an interesting question, because if you're new to business, let's say you're just starting, I would say go sell something you can make money with today. However, would I stay in that for 10 years? No. Would I do it for 1 or 2 years to kind of get the reps? Because it's all about building the getting the cycles of, you know, testing, learning. So trying to do like your own fun when you're starting off, you could do it. But as you know, like with no track record, no reputation, like good luck trying to get somebody to give you money to invest in stuff. Like it's so like a fund would be a tough thing as a first time entrepreneur, whereas, you know, being involved in somebody else's fund and helping raise money for their thing, even though so you'd be selling other people's thing, is probably going to get you more shots on goal, more reps to be able to learn faster, to eventually build a track record. So strategically, I would always say like the thing that has a faster sales cycle when you start, and then eventually start playing the longer game by building foundational kind of like the infrastructure. Because most people, they're always looking for the quick dollar that... You know, they wake up in 25 years and they've just chased a quick dollar and they got nothing to show for it.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious because, you know, you mentioned you got into, you know, social and doing some content 6-7 years ago. I always say, man, like in the environment that we live in today with social media, YouTube, podcasts like this one that we're on right now, I feel like it's really leveled the playing field. You know, if you look 15, 20, 30 years ago, you know, you had celebrities and you had people that were on TV and they had a leg up over the everyday person. But now the everyday person can literally just jump on social media. It's free to post and they can start building out their brand. And it's really leveled out that playing field to where I believe it's never been easier to start a business.
It's never been easier. But the problem is that most people don't know what to say. Dude, Rich, most people have nothing interesting to say. So when I say most people, you grab 100 people, there might be 3 to 5 that actually have an opinion, right? The other 95 are worried about anything they say, if it's going to be looked at a certain way. I mean, it's fascinating to watch somebody absolutely, you know, not be able to just share an opinion on stuff, right? Like we're in it, so we think everybody does it. but I coach a lot of software CEOs, and like amongst that group, there's a lot of consumers. There's not a lot of creators, you know? So the beauty of it is that in today's world, if you find your voice, if you're willing to be courageous, you're willing to put yourself out there, then yes, you will stand above other people. But I mean, this has been true when I started, you know, 10 years ago, I would just blog back then before the video stuff. I was creating content. I was sharing my ideas. And, you know, even in my world of software, like we used to do open source projects. So like our code spoke for us, right? Like people would see us contribute to these open source projects, but it's very few people that are willing to overcome the fears of publishing content. But if they can do it, because business comes down to two things, reach and reputation. Do you have a positive reputation? If so, cool. If not, clean it up. Some people don't. And then reach. It's like, if you can create content that helps other people and that is shared amongst a group of people so that before you even enter a room, they know of your work, that is powerful, right? Yeah. Like that's everything.
What do you think is more important out of the two? Having the confidence to just go out there and not really give a fuck what other people think as a content creator, or actually having experience and clout in order to speak on stuff that people might find valuable? If you love real estate investing, passive income, and tax benefits, but don't have the time, my company, Summers Capital, is buying boutique hotels right now. We source the deals, we renovate the properties, and we even handle all the day-to-day management, making it truly hands-off for our investors. If you want to learn more to see if we can help you, visit summerscapital.com/invest to book a call with our team. Again, that's summerscapital.com/invest. Now back to the show.
I mean, the truth is you just need to be able to speak properly. And the reason why, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm just saying it's true. Because a lot of people, even authors, some authors have never done the thing they're writing about. They're a reporter. So there is a lot of media being produced where the person is researching, you know, curating, creating top lists of stuff. And they can build an incredible kind of brand just being that person, right? Like a productivity expert that, you know, just tries all the tools, reads all the books, and they synthesize and kind of codify what they're reading. They themselves, I mean, I don't want to call people out, but I know dozens of authors that write books on topics they've never done themselves. But from the point of being a reporter, that's kind of the style, they can do that. So I wouldn't want somebody to wait until they have a background and credibility in the thing to start creating content. Because the truth is when I was creating my content, like writing blog posts back in the day, I was just writing about what I was doing. And that's fine too. You don't have to have experience. You can just be like, hey, here's what I'm doing. This is what I've tried. This is what I'm deciding to do. And that's better than nothing. Because some people, again, they want to be, I mean, the truth is it's entertainment, right? Like great content isn't even that informational. You have to make it entertaining.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the perfect example is like Joe Rogan. I mean, he's not an expert in all these different, you know, facets, but he is a good interviewer, all right? And he's done three episodes a week for 14 years on his podcast. And now people view him as expert because he's had all these great guests on. But it is a good point. I don't think you necessarily need to be the expert, at least at first, blog what you're doing and start interviewing people that know what they're doing. Like we're talking about private equity and businesses. I don't know a lot about that side of it. I'm more of a real estate guy, but I'm interviewing you, right?
Well, I mean, let's talk about Joe Rogan. This is the interesting part about it is people do need to have things they're passionate about. Like this is the one thing. I think so many people don't have anything they're passionate about and then they want to create content, right? It's like to be a great writer, you have to live an interesting life. Like Joe Rogan was a martial artist, was a comedian, was an actor before he ever started creating a podcast, right? And he was also fascinated in aliens, right? And also into plant medicine. So like he was all these things. What he did that very few people are willing to do is put themselves out online 100%. Like nobody watches Joe and goes, oh, he's holding back. The guy believes what he believes. He puts it out there. That's his opinion on stuff. Whether you like it or not, it is who he is. And if you like it, cool. And if not, that's fine. And I think that what makes people interesting is having a character diamond, right? Like having a part of you that is, you know, like he's so athletic. I mean, he's got one of the strongest martial art kicks that anybody's ever seen. You know, George St. Pierre says it's like one of the most powerful side kicks he's ever seen. And in the same, you know, breath, he'll tell you about like, you know, how drunk and high he got and then the pizza they ate after the, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's this dichotomy of the yin and the yang that makes him interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And he also has perfect recall. His memory is off the charts. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah.
There's people like Patrick Bet-David, Joe Rogan, and many others, Gary V, another one. They have almost perfect recall in their memory. Like they can tell you 15 years ago, I met this person at this restaurant on the corner of these two streets. Mm-hmm. Rich, I don't got that. I don't know about you though, dude. I'm like, I can't even remember what I did last week.
Yeah, I don't either.
So I think that there's other areas when I think of Rogan that I always admire of him, and it's kind of those things. And those are areas that any person can, if they're willing to expose themselves, lean into it. Mm-hmm. You know, like I love watching reality TV. Like my wife and I right now, selling OC. Is that what we're watching, babes?
Yeah. Selling Sunset?
No, Selling OC. Okay. The Orange County one. Selling Sunset was the first one. So gotcha. Now we're into Selling OC. We watch a lot of reality TV. And people will be like, wow, Dan, you wrote a book about being efficient and stuff. It's so weird.
Yeah.
I also love chocolate and peanut butter. Like addicted to it. Love mm-hmm. it. Like, you know, I don't eat as much because I train hard. But if I could, I'd eat it all the time. Probably make myself sick. So I think it's important for people to just be 100% who they are. And that creates, you know, I don't know. It just makes you more interesting than just like this one dimensional person.
Yeah, I agree. So I would say the majority of the podcast guests that I have on, they have their own mastermind, their own, you know, online education or coaching program as well. Most of them, I would say it's one arm of their business and mm-hmm. they might be an expert in, you know, a specific niche or a specific asset class within real estate investing. But they happen to have a mastermind within that. You know, obviously it's a high profit margin type of business and there's a lot of money out there in the online education. Do you see that as one of the top opportunities in today's space just because of all the social media and content that we have at our disposal today?
Yeah, I mean, the highest gross margins industries are for the most part. So like software is 87% gross margin. That's the world.
87%?
87%. Think about it. I write the code once and if 10,000 people buy it every month, it's fractions of a penny.
Doesn't it always need to be like improved though and there's always bugs?
Yeah. So I mean, there's the argument that there's innovation that has to be there and you fix mm-hmm. bugs. But I mean, you know, if you have a simple tool that connects two systems together and people pay you $20 a month and you don't like, obviously you want to be competitive. If you didn't improve it, then over time it would degrade. But for the most part, like the margins on like a pure cost of goods sold is 87%. That's the industry average, right? Mm-hmm. And I think education is the same, right? I remember my buddy Ramit Sethi, he told me this a long time ago because Ramit did a company back in the day. I knew him when he did PB Wiki. So like a wiki software back in the day. Mm-hmm. And today he runs, you know, an 8-figure plus education company, just came out with a new Netflix show called The Rich Life. I think it's called The Rich okay. Life. And, you know, he's the one that told me, he's like, information companies have the same margins as software companies, right? And I think a great margin business is actually a great business to be in, but most people don't set them up so that it could actually be worth something to somebody else. So yes, they're high margin.
So good cash flow business, but not necessarily an exit.
There's no, most people don't build them in a way that they could exit. Right?
Kent was telling me with his program that one, he thinks it's set up to have some sort of exit at some point.
Yeah. I mean, the test is very simple. It's like, do people buy, get delivered by somebody else? Are you, as a guru, involved in the business? Mm-hmm. Right. So SaaS Academy for me, I have an executive team, senior leadership team. I'm not involved in sales process. I'm not involved in delivery. I'm not involved. I have executive coaches like, whereas I'm zero involved in any operational aspect of it, even the running of it day to day. And as a entity, I mean, we're one of the largest marketing engines for B2B software companies. So we have private equity companies all the time asking us to buy our business because they want access to our customer base, sure. right? We have hundreds of thousands of CEOs of software companies that they're trying to talk to every day. We've got the brand. So I've always built my companies in a way that it could be bought by somebody else because most people don't realize, but what creates true wealth, right, is the ability over time. Yes, it produces cash flow, but what it has to do is create enterprise value. Enterprise value is only valuable if somebody else can buy it and it produced that cash flow, mm-hmm. right? So that's why real estate is where most people have created their wealth, because real estate inherently, it's kind of like a mini business. You buy a apartment building, mm-hmm. it's its own business and it produces cash flow. So if somebody else buys it from you, it'll keep doing that thing. Businesses take at least, you know, I would say 5 million to 10 million plus, definitely if you set it up right. At 10 million plus, if you build it right, that you're no longer required for it to continue to grow, then somebody else can buy it. That's where private equity comes in. And that's the enterprise value. So yes, it might produce $1 or $2 million a year in EBITDA, but the real value of a business at 10 million plus is the fact that you could sell it for, you know, 10 million, 20 million, 30 million. So your wealth creation is not in the cash flow of the business. It's the moment you decide to exit the business.
Mm.
And if people knew that, I think they would just set the foundation up differently so that it could be exited.
Does anyone buy businesses? And let's just say for this is an extreme example, like a lot of Cardone's businesses, right? He's like the main marketer there. And so does anyone buy businesses like that and be like, hey, like you're going to be a consultant or you're still going to like stay on with us post close?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's different ways you can negotiate an acquisition, mm-hmm. but typically depending on those kind of deals where you want the founders to stick around, then they would have an earnout. So there'd be some kind of performance metrics or their employment with the company over a certain amount of time. So you might put like 20% of the deal in escrow. So they would be, if they walked away, they'd be walking away from that amount.
Got it. So it creates an alignment of interest.
Yeah. They've got to make it work out. And I was just on Brandon Dawson's podcast. So we talked a lot about kind of how they set things up. What's interesting about Grant's structure that a lot of people don't pay attention to or don't understand is the 10X brand is the brand. So the 10X brand, see, when people first saw Virgin back in the day in the 1980s, they didn't understand what it was. And like today they go, oh, Virgin, Mobile, Virgin, you know, all these cruises, they understand that it's a brand. But I mean, 10X has the potential to be a brand in the business space, right? So yes, people know it as, you know, Grant's company, but you know, Brandon runs them, right? And mm-hmm. he's the mastermind behind the business infrastructure, and Grant's, you know, he's the talent. He's out there doing the thing, and he's got, you know, Cardone Ventures and his acquisition stuff. And so I think like the way I've seen them execute on their partnership strategy recently, it's actually a masterclass in leveraging of a brand that most people don't see.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Have you seen like they're doing like 10X landscaping?
10X Health.
10X Health. Like, so they essentially, I remember, I think it was 2 years ago, I heard that they hosted a bunch of influencers in Miami. So they grabbed people from all these different online spaces. And they pretty much said like, hey, we want to partner with you guys. Actually, my buddy Pete Vargas did 10X speaking with them.
Mm.
So like, they're essentially saying, we have distribution, we have an audience, we have reach, and we have a reputation. And if you have a great service that we can plug in and we can operationalize it, we can turn it into a repeatable business model, then we can get it more eyeballs and then we can become partners in growing this thing. So, I mean, you have 100 of those. I mean, I'm doing that in my world, but just buying software companies 100%. Like I just buy the company, put it in my holdco. But they're doing it by partnering with these companies. But it's not a crazy world to imagine one day when they have 100 companies like a 10X Health, which from my understanding does about 60 million a year within the first year. I mean, it'll eventually be $300-400 million a year company. If you've got 100 of those, that becomes an incredible holding company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's very few people in the online guru space is doing stuff like that. I would say Alex at acquisition.com, Alex Ramosi and Layla, they're doing this. You know, Ryan Pineda's working on some stuff around his thing. I mean, it's just cool seeing online folks decide to bring more of a business mind and a strategic mind to their distribution, their reach.
Yeah. So when you have a big portfolio under a hold co, does that typically give you a higher multiple at the exit because
always
that buyer's taking advantage of the economies of scale, or why is that?
Yeah, the way it works is like, think of it this way. If I have a $100,000 business, I'm super dependent on the person operating it. So it's not worth a lot to anybody. You know, you get $1 million business, same deal, might generate one or two, you know, 200,000 in EBITDA, whatever. Not a big, you're not going to get anybody excited about waking up out of bed. But when you get to kind of the micro private equity spaces, like 5 million to 10 million, and that's very much on the small side. And the reason why is it's just the ability to produce returns. You know, there's literally people sitting on billions of dollars of what's called dry powder. Okay. They've got cash and they're looking for vehicles that they can deploy this capital into a fund, a structure, a business, a hedge fund, whatever that produces, you know, 20, 30% return per year, right? So the smaller the thing is, the less valuable it is because it doesn't, it's not going to, It's like little bets, right? Mm-hmm. Like these guys that are sitting on $100 million in cash and they want to deploy it, they'd rather buy two $50 million a year companies than buy 10 $5 million a year companies. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a better return on their time too.
Yeah, it's better return on their time, less operational complexity, more predictability in the business. There's more meat on the bones to be able to restructure and fix the profitability in it. And I just think that's what most people don't consider when they look at it. So the bigger the top line revenue just means that there's more infrastructure in that business to tweak and play with to make it produce better returns.
What's Alex Hormozi doing with acquisition.com? Hey guys, real quick, the only way this show grows, the only way we continue to bring on bigger and better guests is if you guys rate, review, and share the show. So if you could take 2 seconds or the click of the thumb to review on Apple or Spotify, it will mean the world to me. But more importantly, we'll be able to reach more entrepreneurs and more real estate investors and help them build wealth through this podcast. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, like, here's what I've learned over the years is business models iterate and pivot. So I can't say what they're doing today.
Sure.
You know, I'm friends with Alex and Layla. I had dinner with them like 3-4 months ago in Vegas. But, you know, I think what they've shared publicly is essentially they, you know, invest in companies. There's a criteria for what that looks like. They get, I mean, thousands of applications a day through their content strategy. And then they choose to do a handful. I mean, it's no different than what Buffett's doing at scale with Berkshire Hathaway. I mean, this is, you know, a long time ago, one of my mentors, Naval Ravikant, he kind of explained it this way. He said, the more you focus and you become the tip of the spear, the more you'll have opportunities from other people's opportunities. So what I mean by this, Rich, is if you're Cardone, Hormozi, Buffett, okay, other people's success, other people's luck in their industry, they come to you because they look up to you. So you think about this, Buffett probably gets dozens of companies that are great run companies that want to sell to him because he has a reputation as somebody that doesn't mess with the company, right? He's never been one to buy your business and then sell it off into pieces, which is what most private equity firms do, right? So he's got a reputation. He's been doing this for, you know, 50, 60 years. And he's literally able to pick and choose the best of the best of the best. And that's why, you know, reach and reputation are really important things to focus on. Like, do you have a reputation? That's why some people starting off, they're just so short-sighted that they, you know, they overreact, they get heated, they screw somebody over. I mean, Rich, you know this, man. It's like one DM away from back channeling with somebody that you used to be business partners with for somebody to tell you what the real deal is. You can't do that anymore. So I just think focusing on, you know, you're like building a personal brand and having ethics and like, and being somebody that does what they say they're going to do, that and like create value for other people. And like a lot of people, like millions of people, like we get, I think we have 8 million people seeing our accounts in the last 30 days. Like, I want to add as much value as I can to people across the internet so that a small handful of folks will come to me when they're ready to do something interesting, specifically around software. I mean, because that's my thing.
Mm-hmm. So these folks that are buying, you know, various types of businesses for their holdco, it seems to me that they don't necessarily need to be the expert in whatever line of business that is. There's a lot of like cross branding and that sort of thing going on within these different types of businesses. So would you say it's understanding the marketing and the business architecture is more important than actually understanding the specific line of business?
Rich, it's going to piss people off when I answer this question, because being a business owner doesn't require you to know anything about business.
Yeah, so I love that.
This is the difference. Being a business owner is different than being a business operator. Mm-hmm. Okay. I can buy a restaurant tomorrow, hire a restaurant operator for about $300,000 a year and have a very successful restaurant. I do not know how to make a sandwich. I mean, I do, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't have to be a restaurateur.
Mm-hmm.
So like when we buy software companies, we just hire CEOs. I have an executive search firm that hires C-level and director level people like that. I can have any specific niche operator hired within 12 weeks. From the moment I decide I need that person, I can hire them. Okay. That's why you need enough profitability in the business you buy to be able to pay that person. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's what a lot of folks don't understand at scale, right? When you're talking about buying a $5-10 million a year business, you can just hire those folks, right? Mm-hmm. Like if I bought a mastermind, let's say there was a real estate mastermind for sale and it was doing $5 million a year. I mean, I could buy it and just hire somebody else to operate it. We build out the incentive structure so that everybody wins. I'm not involved in the business and it could produce, you know, $1 million in cash flow every year for me. And if you buy it right, that's a great business to purchase. But I don't need to know anything about real estate masterminds to own that business. So I think it helps, right? It's just like, I think you should invest in the things you know about, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, business is more about people and strategy, not necessarily the tactics, because I can buy the tactics. Like when I hire people, I always say I'm buying playbooks. Mm. Right. So if I wanted to build a media company, I would just hire somebody who's done it already. And I'm buying playbooks. They have the playbooks. They have the expertise. You got to be good enough to be able to interview them to know that they're not. But even that, like I just have somebody else I trust that knows it to interview the person to tell me if it's the right person.
I love that.
Isn't that crazy? So yeah. I don't even need to know.
I love that. So when we go buy like real estate deals, you know, we're looking at a lot of different things. But one of the main things we're looking at is, what is the value add potential here? What are the value add components? How can we increase the value of this property? Buying businesses, like what are some of those value add components that you guys really look for?
Oh yeah. I mean, so for me, I'm always, in the software world, it's called net revenue retention. Okay. So net revenue retention, essentially, if you think about it this way, I have 100 people that pay me in January this year. Okay. Mm. In 12 months, how many of those 100 people are still going to be there? So most businesses have what's called churn, right? Mm. Cancellations. So even if, let's say 20% of those people churn, so I only have 80 of the 100 still paying me in a year, what I want to try to find out is what's the opportunity for me to expand the revenue with those 100? Okay. So expand, or the 80 that are left over. So that's what's called expansion revenue. So that's what's net revenue retention. I know I'm getting nerdy with people, mm-hmm. but it's an interesting concept to understand. To the degree that that business has clear tweaks and changes I could do to improve the net revenue retention, that's what I'm looking for. So things like if they haven't put their prices up. I mean, this is number one, first thing that we do as soon as we buy a company, put the prices up. Mm. And it's not even putting the prices up, is understanding that in the customer base they might have, let's say they have 1,000 customers, there are some people that are willing to pay a lot more for a different level of service, right? So I don't know if you pay for like Slack or all these other tools, but they have this beautiful business model where you start very cheap, sometimes free. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a year later, you look at your credit card bill and all of a sudden you're paying $300 a month for it. And you're like, whoa, what's happening? Well, you added more seats, you added this extra feature, you wanted integration with this tool. So we're always looking for products that have not optimized those area of their business, but they have strong retention. So as long as they have strong customer retention, then I know how to come in and fix the packaging, pricing, and the what's called the value metric to make sure that we increase the net revenue retention. Because if we can go from, you know, net revenue retention of 80%, meaning that of the 100, you know, only 80 stay, but they don't spend more money. Mm-hmm. So I'm only getting 80% net revenue retention, to a number that's in the 120%, that's the gold standard. Gold standard is 130%. That is an annuity. So think about that, Rich. Every year that those same customers stick around, even if some of them leave, the rest of them that stay spend more, then over time, that's what makes software companies so valuable.
So when you're buying a business, I mean, is this an assumption before you actually acquire
it? No, due diligence, we look at
it. How do you know for sure in due diligence if it's going to work or not, or how much you can actually push the pricing?
Yeah, so there's a thing called the willingness to pay. So pricing is actually a science.
Okay.
So, and there's different survey tools out there to actually survey customer bases to figure out what their willingness to pay is. Okay. Van Westendrop or GERP. There's a survey strategy that says like, out of these seven features, which one do you find most valuable? And you get them to rank order it. And what are you willing to pay for that feature? Right. Mm-hmm. So there's actual survey strategies to tell you what people are willing to pay for different things, what their price sensitivity is. Mm. Okay. So it's a science. Okay. And I have those people on staff. They're like they go to university for this. I mean, one of my pricing experts, Marcos, he's actually from San Diego. He used to work for Vista Private Equity, and he added $1 billion in top line profitability to their business by just changing pricing.
Wow.
Pricing. That's it. Right. So most people have inefficient pricing strategies. So in the due diligence phase, you do a lot of, like, there's kind of like the first level of a data room, and then you create an LOI, letter of intent, you purchase the company. But then in due diligence, you're looking at, you're doing customer interviews, you're looking at the tech stack, you're looking, you
interviewing their clients.
Oh yeah.
Really?
Oh, for sure. Wow. Yeah. 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 I don't want to, you can tell me how great your customers love your thing, but I want to talk to them. So yeah. So you interview their customers, and you can just say, we're a product specialist and we're doing some customer interviews. They don't need to know why. But one of the things that I look for is, again, you asked me, is a nerdy-ish question, but
yeah, I love it. I want to know.
In software, if you think about it, every feature used is logged in the database. Okay, so when your team uses Slack, Slack knows you have an account, you have 13 people on that account, 8 of them are very active, 6 of them use it every day, and on average, they send X amount of messages. It's all in the database. So what I can do is actually pull a histogram analysis of all the customers, what features they use, and how are they, like how popular they are, and then figure out what package, because you know, like on a website, there's like different plans.
Yep.
I can see if it's inefficient based on like everybody uses this, but there's no limits, right? So it might even be like, oh, on the small plan, it's only 3 people. As soon as you go to 4 people, you got to go to the mid-tier plan, right? And oh, if it's a CRM, your value metric, which is like your metered pricing, should be based on number of contacts. So as you go from like 5,000 contacts to 10,000 contacts to 25,000 contacts, that puts you in a different tier. But I can just search, I can look at the data of how the current product is being used to figure out if it's being inefficient. Now, the truth is, this is what I coach my clients on at SaaS Academy. So all I did is took all the playbooks I built for coaching my clients, and we just apply it in the first 100 days in my acquisition company.
I love that.
Yeah.
So what are some other value add components that you like to look for before acquiring a new business?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at reason people cancel. I think this is the biggest one, Rich. Like, you know, in real estate, you know, why do people leave a building or whatever? Like, that feedback is one of the most important things, but most people don't ever look at it. So think about this. If I have 10 people canceling my business every month, most entrepreneurs would be like, oh, those people weren't the right fit, blah, blah, blah. I want to know why. I never change anything in the product unless it's driven by cancellations.
So if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly. So a lot of people, they get excited and they add a bunch of stuff, but because they're not looking at the reason people cancel, they just add complexity. See, most people, it's easy to add stuff to a product to make it better because it's like, hey, Rich, why don't we add this? You're like, oh, that's a good idea. Add it, add it, add it, add it. And then you wake up one day and you have an operationally complex business. So our rule is, unless the customer's canceling for that reason, we don't do anything to improve it. But obviously there's always people are canceling for whatever reason. So we take that feedback. We use that to drive what's called the product roadmap. How do we make the product better? And then, if we add something, we also ask ourselves, what do we take away? So this is a big one. In software, if you don't, you create this thing called featureitis. So if you keep adding features, then you ever use a software and it's got too many buttons and clicks and it's just like confusing?
That, and then the learning curve can be a little bit challenging.
Okay, so then you have a complex learning curve, which means you don't get people activating the product when they first use it because it's complicated. And then you got to hire a consultant to deploy it, which makes the whole thing pointless.
Sure.
So that's like from a philosophy point of view, and this can be applied to coaching organizations or masterminds or whatever. It's like, if you're going to add something new, you should also ask yourself, what are you willing to take away? And what do the customers value? And if people are canceling, why did they cancel? And if it's because you didn't have something that they would expect, you might want to consider adding that first so you can increase your retention.
How do you know which is the right item to take away if you were to remove something?
You look at the usage.
Okay.
So this is the hard part, Rich. Most people don't want to take stuff away because, you know, they have 7 out of 100 people using it.
Yeah.
I look at it as like, if less than 1% of my customers are complaining about something, I don't even bother working on it. Like, it's 1%. It's like, it's not enough. I wouldn't even get the team working on something if it's like, so sometimes people, they forget to put things into percentages. When you're small and you have 10 customers, one customer is 10%. Okay. But when you got 1,000 customers and one person's not happy, that's like 0.5%. So like, don't get distracted by one customer. This happens all the time. You know, customer support, they want to go out of their way. Your team's like, oh, this customer was upset because this happened. It's like, look, I'm not happy they're upset, but the grand scheme of things, let's stay focused on something that's going to add value for our whole customer base, not just fix it for one person.
Yeah.
So yes, you want to make sure that you look at why somebody left, but you also don't want to get distracted by, you know, the squeaky wheel when there's no numbers to support it. So I always try to normalize everything into a percent of total customers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then you got a due diligence period typically.
Yeah.
And in this industry, typically how long is a due diligence period?
We'd like to get everything done within, you know, 60 days would be long, but 45 is probably the norm.
Okay. And what are some of the other items that you guys are looking through during this DD? Oh,
there is a crazy checklist. I mean, we're looking at IP assignment. So like who owns the intellectual property that you built, right? So we need a list of everybody you've ever employed and show us that they've signed an agreement that has an intellectual property assignments. Because remember the whole Facebook thing with the Winklevoss twins?
No.
Well, it was in the movie, but essentially like they hired Mark to build this social network. Mark decided to build his own. He called it Facebook. The Winklevoss said, well, that was our idea. And I mean, he had to write a check for like $400 million or something.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's part of it. You know, financials. I mean, I don't know if you've ever gone to buy a business or even a real estate project and they say the numbers look like X and then you do like some level of financial hygiene and you're like, yeah, those numbers were totally off.
Yeah.
You know, because most entrepreneurs actually don't know how to read their numbers. So, you know, we do a financial audit. I would say IP, patent stuff, making sure that they're not, you know, infringing on anything. There's no like third party tools that they might be using they didn't disclose. You know, the team structure, just make sure that everybody's actually committed to the long term vision. If I don't want to buy a company and have everybody quit the next day.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that yeah, just so creates
it sounds
a lot
like
of
a lot of similarities between that and buying real estate. I mean, we always want like 12 months of bank statements so we can verify the income.
Yeah.
Ideally tax returns as well. Utility statements, all that sort of thing. Is the value add when buying a business sometimes reducing your payroll expenses?
It depends on what your strategy is. If you're a buyer and you're just trying to milk as much cash flow, then yes. And there's companies out there, private equity firms, that they specialize in buying operationally inefficient companies, trimming all the expenses, outsourcing the development to, you know, South America or some other part of the world where it's cheaper dev costs. And that is 100% a strategy. Ours is more about, you know, buying a great asset and building it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's
it's hard to grow the top line if you're shrinking the payroll.
Yeah. And I mean, in software, like it's all about innovation, right? Mm-hmm. So you can buy a product that has heavy locked in features, right? Like a CRM tool or like a government product. But you don't, if you want to build something for long term, you know, 15 years from now, then you got to invest in the innovation. You can't just try to suck as much cash flow out of it or it's going to eventually degrade. It's like mm-hmm. a building. If you don't put anything back into the operating of it, mm-hmm. then over time you're going to have just like a race to the bottom.
What about the decision to like take a company public?
Yeah.
You know, I see, I don't do a lot of investing into Wall Street, but I see a lot of these companies trade at these crazy numbers and valuations and they're not even profitable.
Yeah.
And so I guess like when you have a startup or maybe you're buying a small business and your strategy is to take it public, what typically like drives that decision if you should or not do it?
It's all about capital raising. See, most people don't realize that going public is an exercise in raising capital, right? So there's different markets to raise capital. There's obviously like, you know, early stages, credit cards, and then, you know, you've got your angel investors and, you know, that's an equity structure. You can do debt. But public, it provides access to a broader pool of capital and it also provides liquidity. So that's another thing, right? So like a lot of private companies that have investors, like I'm an investor in almost 100 companies. I have no liquidity amongst most of them. The bigger ones like an Intercom, there's buyers out there that'll buy my stock as a private company, but there's not a lot of liquidity. So, you know, sometimes strategically it's getting access to the public markets who also give you better valuation. So like you mentioned, you know, these companies that are not profitable, they go public. Well, they'll get, I mean, geez, I think what was Tesla's stock trading at like 120 price to earning ratio. I mean, it's just PE rate. They're kind of out of whack. Like it doesn't make sense, but they're buying.
Airbnb is another one.
Yeah, but they're buying on discounted cash flow in the future. So you're buying today with an anticipation that in the future it'll be worth more. I mean,
do you think they're getting a higher value by going public because the investment amount is a much smaller amount from all of these different people?
I think it goes back to there's people with billions of dollars in dry powder that they have to deploy it, and they can't even buy private companies. So they have to buy public companies, and they need to put enough money into one thing to be able to, you know. So I think that's why public markets are an opportunity to raise capital. Amazon's never been profitable, right? But what they have is free cash flow. So it's like when you look at the unit economics of the business, it produces a lot of cash. Now, they would rather invest in, you know, new, you know, shipping centers all over the world than take any profit out and give a distribution to their investors, right? So Amazon from the beginning.
So you're saying they're redeploying a lot of their profits into growth.
And that's what you should do.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why I love Mr. Beast. I mean, think about, you know, Jimmy. Like, he literally says that video cost me, I made $4 million in advertising and I put $4 million into that video. Right. Mm-hmm. He's playing the long game. Like, people are like, oh, this guy doesn't have any savings. Rich, people don't get this. Like, if Mr. Beast decided to stop making videos and he's got, let's call it 60 different channels, because he's got all his different language channels. Okay?
Right.
And never produce another video, I got to assume he's doing $1 million or more in just advertising per month on his backlog. You know, it's kind of like a music, like a Taylor Swift, right? Like, his catalog of videos will continue to produce revenue. So he's sitting on, I mean, probably more, right?
Does Mr. Beast have like businesses and back-end products?
He's got Feastables.
Okay.
I mean, Feastables, I don't know how good the burger company is doing anymore. It was one of the largest launches of the physical store was. But I think there might have been a partnership issue with the product quality and stuff, because they did the ghost kitchen concept where they like were on, you know, Grubhub and all these other, food delivery services, but they didn't actually have a restaurant. Mm-hmm. See, a lot of people don't even know that idea of a ghost kitchen, right? Yeah. So like a lot of these, you know, food brands, when you're ordering from these apps, there's no physical location, right? You're ordering the burger and it's cooked in the same kitchen as 15 other burgers, right? Which I think is a fascinating idea.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, it's super cool. But Mr. Beast did that with the Beast Burgers. He's got Feastables. I mean, my kids literally, we go travel. We run around a city looking for Prime and chocolate bars by Feastables, Mr. Beast chocolate bars.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't Prime Logan Paul's
exactly
company?
Okay. Yeah. So we call it Prime hunting.
Prime on what?
Prime hunting. My kids will like get on the scooters.
They're in 7-Eleven now, right?
Dude, but there's rare flavors. Okay. I mean, what a cool concept. Yeah. You know, they're like, so right now, I forget what it's called. It's the green one and it's a rare. So like, if you go into a 7-Eleven and you see the green flavor, whatever, you have to look through the bottles and you might find a rare one. It's it's got like a shiny finish to it. Okay. So my son the other day, he went into a gas station. He saw that they had the green flavor, but he looked through and he found the rare one that was in the stack. And like, you know, that's, so I just think like a lot of these online influencers, you know, they use their distribution. They can monetize. Yeah. So most people in media, these are all the things you don't know. It's kind of like rich people. You know how like you have these friends that have like watch collections and car collections, all this stuff. And you're like, man, that's crazy. How much money do you spend on your cars? They're like, oh, I got about 5 million in cars. Those people have $5 million in assets. They're not liabilities. Rich, you know these people. They have collections of cars. Some of them, they get allocations from Porsche and Ferrari, et cetera. And when they get that allocation, the day they get that car, they could sell it for an extra $100,000. Like, these are not like rich people buy things completely different than other people. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's the same thing with the media, is that a lot of media folks, they're monetizing their media through advertising, where the media itself can pay for the production of the media. So all the increase in reach is their value that they get to keep, but they get to fund it through the income generation of the media.
It's massive.
Dude, I think if people understood that, they would actually like be more excited about producing content when they realize like, oh, your content creation can actually fund the creation. And then all the reputation building is something you can leverage down the road.
Yeah, no, it's a massive opportunity. So would you almost say that the branding and the reach is the most, like the marketing is the most important piece of a business, like the ones you're alluding to?
It's everything.
Yeah.
It's everything. I mean, here's where
as a software business, maybe less?
No, I think it doesn't matter. I mean, distribution is distribution, right? I think that, and this is what Gary Vee's been saying for years, is your personal brand will be the thing you take with you forever. So I have a client the other day, she's like, hey, should I start a podcast? I was like, yes, start the podcast under your name and it's sponsored by your software. See?
Yeah.
She's like, oh, that's awesome. It's like, yes, because you'll be able to take your podcast with you to the next business, the next idea, but you can point that traffic, that attention.
Wherever you want.
Exactly. So like, Dan Martell has always been Dan Martell. I'm that on Instagram, all my YouTube, et cetera. I've had three software companies that I've exited. I've got SaaS Academy. I now have Big Band Software, my holding co. And I might have 15 other projects. I might invest in a company and just want to point some attention to it. And the more I invest in the media side of my life, the more I have the ability to expand my reach.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think the social media thing right now is massive. The opportunity is huge. We talked about it earlier in the show. Like, it's just really leveled the playing field for the everyday person to compete with a lot of these people that in the past, the only way to, you know, build that brand was through TV or those sort of, you know, platforms. And so I don't know. I mean, I'm seeing it everywhere. I mean, look at the biggest influencers right now. Those are the ones that have back-end products. Are just crushing it.
Well, and this is the thing that I find fascinating is back in the day, you know, the TV people, they control, there was people that controlled the distribution, right? So it's like, if you wanted to be like a household name, you had to get like a, you know, Home and Garden, you needed a TV project. Now it's the streamers, but man, I would argue that, you know, YouTube and TikTok, I mean, I'm all in owning my audience and then deciding if I want to do a collab. Even like writing a book, you know, back in the day, you used to have to like sign a deal with a publisher and the publisher took the majority of the royalties. Sure. But now people are self-publishing because there's these hybrid deals where you can own the digital rights. I mean, most books that are sold, like our book, Wall Street Journal bestseller, keeps selling more copies week over week. And I did a book deal with Penguin Random House, you know, and they were great partners on that book. But, you know, going forward, I think I'd have to relook at the economics because, I mean, I'm the one promoting the book. It's my book. And, you know, especially with digital downloads, I mean, with a Kindle sale and an audiobook sale, it's all margin. You want to talk about high gross margin? I mean, it's 99% margin, right?
Yeah. What's the real value as an entrepreneur, like, you know, content creator writing a book? Do you recommend it?
Well, I put it off for a decade. I had friends of mine ask me to write a book for years. I didn't need a book. Financially, it was not a thing that was on my, I wasn't a professional speaker.
Hormozi sells his book for what, 99 cents?
99 cents, yeah. And he has to charge 99 cents because that's how Amazon works. But now that it's been out, it's been one of the most powerful things I've ever done in my life. And the reason why is I underestimated the value of a book, which is funny because I've read over 1,600 books. I am built by books. Okay. I can tell you, you show me a book I've read and I'll tell you the idea and how it made me money. So it's funny that even as somebody that's read so many books and continues to read, I undervalued putting a book out for my audience. And the day it dropped, I saw a bunch of people that could have never bought anything from me prior because I didn't have anything for them. I'm a software guy, support the book and continue to support the book. So like I'm leaving here to go to Vegas to keynote the YPO event at F1 because of the book. They didn't need me. Like there was no Dan speaking at that event prior to the book. Even though I've done some really cool things in my life, now that I'm an author, best-selling author of Buy Back Your Time, that has credibility. This is fascinating, right, Rich? Because like I was still the Dan before the book came out, but now that I've got the book, now I'm the author of that book. And media, TV, speaking gigs have all come up. And then those audiences are the people I want to do business with.
Yeah.
So I would highly recommend it.
If you could dumb it down to like just one characteristic or personality trait that separates a successful entrepreneur versus those who give up, fail, or never even get started to begin with. What is that one trait?
The ability to deal with a high level of uncertainty. You got to be able to deal with a high level of uncertainty. And that's why most entrepreneurs, I talk about in my book, can deal with chaos because most grew up in chaos to a certain degree, right? They went through some challenges. And in those challenges, they learn to deal with uncertainty. And it turns out in business, that ability is what's rewarded. Think about it, man. In the eye of the storm, everybody else would be freaking out, crying, having anxiety, depression. Like they would just be like, you're just like, bring it.
Yeah.
Let's make a list. Let's attack it. No problem.
So it's the ability to welcome the fear of the unknown.
Yeah. It's literally saying, I don't know what the path forward is, but I trust that I'll figure it out. And I'm okay with not knowing. Yeah. Every person that has a job that works at a company, they need to know if I show up, I get a paycheck. Entrepreneurs go, I trust that if I create value, at some point I will be paid for that value. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay not knowing exactly how all that works out. Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
I love that. Well, my man, I appreciate you coming on, dude. I could talk to you for hours and hours. It's super fun. It's been very inspiring for myself. And I appreciate you coming out, man.
That was a pleasure. Thanks, Rich.
Yeah. He's Dan Martell. I'm Rich Summers. Listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one. Peace.